All right, so this is May 10th, next to the last Bio 160 lecture. And let's answer the questions on urinary system before we continue with the reproductive system. And if we need to look at some diagrams on the board or something, we can do that. Maybe we'll just do that. So I think we did number one. Know the structures of the urinary system, like kidneys, ureter, urethra, urinary bladder. Make sure you know the functions of the urinary system, the shape and location. I think that's where we left off last time. Well, the shape of a, yeah. I think I have, last time, the questions for urinary?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the back. Now I have one more. Yeah, I'll have to make copies after class for you guys.
Okay.
I don't know. I made a ton of them. I don't know what happened to them. Digestion. And then this stack right here is, that's reproduction. And I just don't have any more. I tell you what, if I can use somebody's in the front, then I can give this one away to somebody. So I'll just share with somebody that's sitting in the front. Pass that back. Okay, describe the shape and location of the kidneys. What does retroperitoneal mean? The shape is what?
Kidney.
They're kidney bean shaped. It means it kind of has like two lobes to it. Superior, inferior lobe, kind of flat. They're about as big as your fist. And they're located in your superior abdominal area in the posterior part. All right, so kind of in your back. They're surrounded by fat. They're kind of embedded in some muscle that protects them. But they're not really in your abdominal cavity. They're actually even behind your abdominal cavity. And because of that, we say they are retroperitoneal. Your abdominal cavity is in a peritoneal membrane. And since they're outside that peritoneal membrane, it's what we call retroperitoneal. Okay? All right, so that's what that means. Next thing, know the gross anatomy of the kidneys. Well, what's the gross anatomy? Surrounding the whole kidney, you got a renal capsule. And it's just connective tissue because the kidney does not have any muscles inside of it, little skeletal muscles anyway, doesn't have any bones. So it's not very strong, kind of a weak organ. The only thing that keeps it together really is the connective tissue capsule that surrounds the whole kidney. And then if you look on the inside of the kidney, you see the pyramids and you see the renal columns. So here is that kidney bean shaped thing. If we slice it open, we see areas that look like this. Guess what these are called? The renal pyramids. Yeah. They kind of all point down into the medulla of the kidney, like that. These are the renal pyramids. This area right here, that's the renal cortex, right? So here's cortex. And the renal pyramids are in where? The medulla of the kidney. And in this area right here, so the pyramids are producing urine, and the urine is collected in some ducts that we call calyces, minor calyces. And when a couple minor calyces come together, when they anastomose together, then that would be a major calyx. And then if you have a bunch of major calyces, then they empty into something we call the pelvis, the renal pelvis. It's a funnel-shaped part of the kidney that's taking urine and funneling it into this tube right here. And who can tell me the name of this tube right here? That would be the ureter. And where does that take urine? To the urinary bladder. And then how does it get out of your body? The urethra. So that's the gross anatomy of the kidneys. Next question, what's the functional and structural unit of the kidney called? And as a matter of fact, maybe I would reword that a little bit. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? Same answer? That's the nephron that does that. Okay, and what are the parts of a nephron? What are the two main parts? Not the little parts, but conceptually, how would you want to organize the nephron? It's got two different kinds of elements. Did we go over that? Yes, it's got vascular elements and tubular elements. What kind of stuff is in a vascular element? Blood. And what's in a tubular element? A filtrate. Yeah. So let's see. Let's start by creating filtrate. Where does filtrate begin? It begins, let's try this pen right here. Bowman's capsule. And you have a nice diagram to practice labeling. The one in your book is a little bit tough, but the one that I passed out is real easy. Bowman's capsule. So there's filtrate. So I will put tubular elements right here. Number one. It starts with Bowman's capsule. Then what happens? Where does filtrate go? Yeah, the old proximal convoluted. Can you picture convoluted in your mind? Tubule. Proximal convoluted tubule. Then where? Then it goes into that loop of Henle, and in particular, the descending loop. Oh, you know, I should have a bunch of people come up. We could do like a little competition, three people who could do this fast. Okay. Descending loop of Henle. Yeah, you're not going to win something, so you could come back next week, though. Okay, descending loop of Henle. And then you got the ascending loop of Henle. All right, so when you write this stuff down, you might want to have a nice picture in your mind of what this stuff looks like. All right, so ascending loop, and then what comes after that? The distal convoluted tubule, convoluted. All right, and so again, this is all twisty and curved and a lot of turns in it. And the distal convoluted tubule then carries filtrate into the last part of the nephron, namely the collecting duct. And then when it leaves the collecting duct, so in all of this stuff here, we got stuff called the filtrate. And it's being processed. And then coming out of the collecting duct, it's done being processed. What do we call that? Urine. The excretory product. Right, so these are the tubular elements. Don't forget, you have vascular elements as well. Number two. It's all on, yeah, it's all on there, okay. Oh, you can't fit it all on there. Microfiche. Vascular elements. Probably not. Afferent. Arteriole. That's bringing blood into the glomerulus. That's the first capillary bed. Glomerulus. And blood is going to leave the glomerulus through a vein? Oh, an arteriole. Efferent, not a vein. Efferent, arteriole. So if this is not a vein, it's an arteriole, where is it going to go to? Another capillary bed, namely peritubular capillaries. Peritubular. So this is unusual for a circulatory system to have two capillary beds back to back. Usually it's just one, right? Peritubular capillary, and then it goes back to a vein, renal vein. So these are the vascular elements. And then lastly, I'm sure we're going to have to answer this in the study questions. What about the processes? How many are there?
Three.
Number one, filtration. Where does it take place? Glomerulus, between Bowman's cap. Yeah, when stuff leaks out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. So let's put in parentheses, which way is this process going? Filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? Blood to filtrate. Blood going into the filtrate. All right, process number two. I like that. Tubular reabsorption. Now, which way does stuff move for this process? Filtrate the blood. Okay, and we're going to fill in a couple little spots right here. And then the third process, tubular secretion. And how does that go? Kind of like filtration. Blood to filtrate. And you might have to know some examples of stuff that are worked on by these processes. What about blood to filtrate? For filtration, almost everything, anything that's small, leaves the blood. Water, sodium, it just leaves. All right, so every small thing, up to about the level of a large protein, gets filtered. What about tubular reabsorption? What gets reabsorbed? Okay, think of a small molecule that gets filtered. If it gets filtered, that means it's going to get lost. You're going to lose that molecule. But think of some small molecules you don't want to lose a lot of. Yeah, sodium. Water. Glucose. Are some things that you want to reabsorb from the filtrate and put it back in blood. All right, and then there are other things that are going to be secreted. Maybe through filtration right here, you can't get rid of every little small molecule that's bad for you. So maybe you want to even get rid of more. And a good example of that would be, for instance, urea would be good. And maybe your book makes a point of some other things that you have in excess. Maybe excess, if you have way too much sodium or way too much potassium in your body or way too much acid in your body, that will be secreted into the renal tubule or to a tubular nephron. Okay. Wow, did we answer all those questions already? Yeah. We named the vessels. We named the three steps or processes which work together to produce urine. Where does filtration take place? That's in the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. What about resorption and secretion? Those are along the tubule someplace, not in the Bowman's capsule. All right, and what makes up, now here's one that we haven't answered yet. What makes up the filtration membrane? The filtration, remember the respiratory membrane had a bunch of four components to it. It had surfactant, wall of the alveolus, wall of the capillary. All right, but the filtration membrane is the wall of the glomerulus, right? And wall of Bowman's capsule. Those two things. Yeah. What makes up the filtration membrane? It's the wall of the glomerulus, that's a capillary, and wall of Bowman's capsule. Those two things. Wall, yeah, it's the wall of Bowman's capsule, wall of the glomerulus, yeah. Right, that's the glomerulus. Okay, yes. Capillary bed number one is this one right here.
Okay.
Number one. And number two is? Exactly. Peritubular capillary. Yeah. Good brain tweezer questions. Huh? Capillary bed number two is peritubular capillary. And what connects the glomerulus with the peritubular capillary? That would be the efferent arteriole. You have a diagram of that. Efferent arteriole connects those two capillaries. All right, how much of the initial filtrate becomes urine? So, I didn't draw it out here. Okay. So you have filtration working away. And whatever blood goes into the glomerulus, about 19 or 20% of it ends up in the filtrate. But this question is, of what is ever in that filtrate, how much is actually lost in the urine? You know what? Only 1%. Yeah, only a little tiny fraction. 99% of everything that gets filtered gets reabsorbed, because most of what you lose is water. And I think I did a calculation one time. If you didn't reabsorb water, you would dehydrate in, I think, 30 seconds or something. So your kidney is very busy reabsorbing water all the time. Okay, so only 1% gets lost in the urine. The name three hormones that regulate kidney function by acting as antidiuretics or diuretics. Well, one of them has a name, and that's what? Antidiuretic hormone, ADH. And maybe you could remember where that came from. That's not part of the question, but that comes from the posterior pituitary. And what does it do in terms of producing urine? Antidiuretic hormone, what does it do? Does it help produce urine, or does it cut back the production? It decreases urine production, so it will help you conserve water when you're not in a well-hydrated state. Antidiuretic hormone will help you retain water. And so that's one. ADH is one. What's another one? How about aldosterone? Aldosterone is another one. And does that help you conserve water, or does that help you lose water? Okay, as a matter of fact, let's go back to antidiuretic. If it's a diuretic, makes you what? Pee. Antidiuretic helps you conserve water. So let's put that down. Conserve body water. And what about aldosterone? You know what? Does the same thing. It helps you conserve water. And then a third hormone, okay, this is a very important system regulating your water balance inside your body. So would you guess that you would like to have antagonistic control or just tonic control over this thing? What about your heart? Is that important to regulate your heart?
Yes.
Yeah. What kind of control is your heart under? Involuntary, I agree. But is it antagonistic? Or is it just tonic? Are there two nerves that go to your heart, or just one? There are two, right? There's the parasympathetic nerve and the sympathetic nerve, and they're opposite to each other. They're antagonistic. So for water balance, that's just as important. So we need to have antagonistic control. But what you see between ADH and aldosterone, they work the same way. There's got to be a hormone that does something different, that has the opposite effect. And that is natriuretic hormone. And what does that do? That doesn't conserve water. That helps you what? Lose water, excrete water. It's a diuretic. Natriuretic hormone. And that comes from, where does this one come from? The atrium of your heart. So as your heart starts to stretch, because there's a lot of fluid coming back to the heart, it's going to stretch. The atria secrete this hormone to help get rid of that extra fluid that's coming back to your heart. So we'll say atrial natriuretic hormone promotes water loss, namely, it produces a diuresis, makes you go to the bathroom. What else we got here? Which ones are synergistic? Oh, which ones are antagonistic? Aha! I was reading my own mind. Okay? Which ones of these are synergistic? That means have the same effect. Number one and number two, right? ADH and aldosterone are synergistic. They work together to produce the same kind of thing. And which ones are antagonistic? Yeah, three is antagonistic to two, right? So atrial natriuretic hormone opposes the action of aldosterone. And also atrial natriuretic hormone opposes the action of antidiuretic hormone. And can you see why this is a really good thing to have? Give me a good example, everyday example, of why having antagonistic mechanisms in something is very useful. Yeah, gas pedal and brake pedal in your car. You wouldn't want to drive your car without both of them working, right? That gives you precise control and balance over how fast you're going and where you're going to go. Okay. Number seven, know the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Well, what kind of mechanism? It's most important for what? Yeah, the long-term regulation of blood pressure, day in and day out. There's another mechanism that regulates your blood pressure at a moment's notice, like when you stand up or something, change body position. That's the baroreceptor reflex. Yeah, ooh, I'm throwing money around. The baroreceptor reflex. All right, but this one is for long-term. It's not going to help you when you stand up, but it's going to help you from day to day or week to week. And that's the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. So how about if we write that on the board? And you should be able to write this out on a piece of paper too, just a blank piece of paper. So follow along with me. Okay, so there goes the nephron. Yeah, we're going to start with the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. So if you think of something that operates through your nervous system by nerves, you think that it can operate fast or slow as compared to something that operates through hormones? Is that fast or slow relative to each other? What do you think is faster working, your nervous system or your hormone system? Nervous system. Yeah, because it works by what? The electricity, that bioelectricity, very fast. And the baroreceptor reflex is operated through what? Not necessarily through hormones, but through your nervous system, through receptors in your nervous system, so it's fast. But the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism works through hormones, so that means that it's what? Relatively slow. Okay? All right, so the initial stimulus would be a decrease in blood pressure for whatever reason. Maybe you're not drinking fluids. Or maybe you're sweating a lot, you're losing fluids. Or maybe you've had a hemorrhage. You've lost blood somehow. Or maybe you have, should I tell you? There's another reason. Gross. Maybe you have diarrhea and you're losing fluids. Okay, all kinds of reasons why you could be losing fluids and losing blood pressure as a result. All right, so if you're decreasing blood pressure, what will you want to do? Would you want to put fluids in your vascular system or take more fluids out? Put in. That's right. Just think of your car tire. If your tire is low in pressure, do you take air out or put air in? You put air in, right? So the same thing for your cardiovascular system. If you're losing blood pressure, you should put more fluid in your blood, not take fluid out. All right. So the initial stimulus, for whatever reason, decrease blood pressure, okay, your kidney is going to sense that decrease in blood pressure, and it's going to secrete something into the blood. The kidney is going to secrete, so we're going to say increase plasma. And what's plasma? That's just your blood. Increase plasma renin. And this is an enzyme that's going to convert something to something else. Meantime, your liver is producing a chemical compound all the time, day in and day out, called angiotensinogen. And whenever you see a word with an ogen on the end of it, what does that mean? That's inactive, right? It's ready to go to work. You have a lot of it in your body, but it's just in reserve. It's there, but it's not working. This chemical compound, renin, right here, is what activates angiotensinogen and converts it into we got to get rid of that ogen, angiotensin. And we call it angiotensin 1. And angiotensin 1 is not really active yet. It has to be converted into the active form. And that's called angiotensin 2. And mostly where that takes place is in the lung. So mostly what facilitates the conversion of 1 into 2 is in the lung. And that's called an angiotensin converting enzyme. Sometimes we call it ACE. ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. And you might have some family member that has problems with blood pressure, hypertension, for instance, and they're taking a chemical compound called an ACE inhibitor. Well, it's an inhibitor that's going to work on this enzyme right here. When we see the whole mechanism, you'll see how it works. Okay. Angiotensin 2 is going to go to the adrenal cortex. So angiotensin 2 is a hormone that travels everywhere in the blood, goes to the adrenal cortex, and it's going to stimulate the adrenal cortex into secreting, okay, another hormone. That's aldosterone. So let me go up over here. Aldosterone, which is a hormone. It goes everywhere in the body. And in particular, it goes back to the kidney. And at the kidney, it causes sodium, yep, and water, yeah, reabsorption. Which means what? Conserve water. Yeah, conserve water and salt. All right. So if you stop losing water, what happens to your blood volume? All right, so let's draw that in. So we have increased blood volume, but you're right. I'm just making this a little bit long and drawn out just so I don't miss a step. And if we increase our blood volume, that's like putting air in a tire, what happens to our blood pressure? Yeah. So we'll say increase blood pressure. Increase blood pressure. Now, what was the initial stimulus to this whole mechanism? Drop in blood pressure. The results? With the angiotensin aldosterone mechanism, increase in blood pressure, what do these things do? Do they add or subtract from each other? They subtract. So what kind of feedback mechanism do we call that when it subtracts? Is that positive feedback or negative feedback? That's what we call negative feedback. And negative feedback, don't forget, even though we call it negative feedback is the good one, right? Positive feedback is the one you don't want to have. Because if it was positive feedback, what would happen here, right? There would be a decrease in blood pressure, which would cause blood pressure to go down even more, which would cause a decrease in blood pressure, which would cause blood pressure to go down even more. And then what would happen? Well, you pass out and then you die. That's kind of what happens when someone goes into shock, cardiovascular shock, and people do die of that positive feedback mechanism. So when somebody's kind of shocky, what's a good way to get their blood pressure back? Increase their blood volume by hooking them up to an IV and give them an IV of some saline or something to increase their blood volume that increases their blood pressure, and hopefully that revives them and they can start regulating by themselves. Okay, so what did we call this whole thing right here? This is the, let me see if I can do it in a different color. This is the renin angiotensin, ooh, I'm running out of ink, aldosterone mechanism. Okay, so make sure you can, I don't think you have to memorize it to the degree where you got to be able to understand every little piece, but I think you should memorize it to the degree where you can write it down on a piece of paper and then use your diagram to answer a question. All right? So make sure you can draw this out to help you understand what's going on. But basically, that whole mechanism will increase your blood pressure. All right. Now, what happens if... So here's a mechanism that increases your blood pressure. But there's a very common pathology around. A lot of people have too high a blood pressure. What do we call it? You have too high a blood pressure. Hypertension, right? So this mechanism right here produces what? An increase in blood pressure. So this is the mechanism that we believe causes that pathology in people that have hypertension. So what are some ways to help people with hypertension? Give them an ACE inhibitor. Okay, that's a common drug to have. Another drug to have to take would be a diuretic like Lasix that decreases their blood volume, which decreases their blood pressure. Yeah. Okay, I hate that one though. Okay. All right, so you could take some drugs like a diuretic and an ACE inhibitor. There's even a new one out that's called an aldosterone receptor blocker, or an ARB that blocks the effect of aldosterone. I don't know how well that one's working out. And for a lot of people that have hypertension, they can't just take one drug. They have to take little combinations of each, because if you just take a diuretic, your body tries to compensate. So if you can block it in a couple areas, then you can reduce the amount of each one of those drugs that you take. They work together to help you out. Okay, but probably the best, what's the best advice for somebody that has hypertension? Change your diet. Okay, and exercise. Usually if someone asks you, well, what can I do? And if it's any kind of disease, almost always the best answer is diet and exercise. Okay, and various people have told me, I don't have any scientific evidence, that when somebody has hypertension, chances are they would not have hypertension if they could lose 10 pounds. All right, so that means they don't have to put up with any of the nasty side effects with these drugs that do this. All right, so that's a tough one. Because how hard is it to lose 10 pounds? Well, you could lose 10 pounds, but the next week you'll gain it again, right? So it's almost impossible. Unless you're really serious about it. Oh, we got more questions probably. Okay. Right, so what organ secretes renin?
Kidney.
Okay. And under what conditions? It secretes renin when your blood pressure goes down or when you lose fluids, right? Okay. And what organ secretes aldosterone? Aldosterone comes from the adrenal cortex. Right here, and then it goes to the kidney, but it comes from the adrenal cortex. All right, and where does ADH come from? Oh, I erased ADH. That comes from the posterior pituitary. The posterior pituitary. And then the last drug was atrial natriuretic hormone. Remember that list that I had on the board? Atrial natriuretic hormone, where does that come from? Heart, the atrium of the heart. Sorry for the people that are listening to the tape. I hit the microphone. Okay. All right, so that's it for urinary system. And that's what's on your quiz for today. It's a little too early to take the quiz. And you all probably want to talk about sex anyway. So, if we must. I think we did a pretty good job covering stuff that's on the quiz. Okay, let's see if you can follow this quiz here. What does that look like? Yeah, good. I'm glad you didn't say ear. kidney, and what are these things? Ureters. And the ureters go to the urinary bladder, and then the bladder has another tube, right? So we got kidney, ureter, bladder, urethra. Okay, now this bladder right here, it's got a special little area. What's this little area right here? Yeah, the trigon. So we call that the trigon. It's between where the two ureters enter and the urethra exits. Okay. There's a little sphincter down over here that can close off the urethra so you don't urinate. There's no sphincter here, so the kidneys can always put urine into the bladder, no problem. Okay. Trigone. All right, does anybody have any questions on urinary system? No? Okay. Well, let's see if the overhead projector works. All right. It does. So where the heck did we leave off last time? Mitosis, meiosis. Did we talk about these secondary reproductive structures? That's where we left off. Okay. Well, the primary one is the testes that produces gametes. Don't forget what a gamete is. How many chromosomes does a gamete have? Half the normal number, right? Which is 23. So if you know the exact number, that's fine. But probably knowing half of the usual number is probably even more important. And what's that process that produces sperm? What do we call that? That's meiosis, because it cuts the number of chromosomes in half. What's the name of the process that produces new cells with the same number of chromosomes called? That would be mitosis. Yeah. All right. Well, the testes not only produces sperm, but it produces testosterone, and there are various structures in a person's body that's sensitive to testosterone, and that is these structures right here. So these are male structures that respond to testosterone: scrotum, the epididymis, vas deferens, seminal vesicles, prostate, bulbo, urethral gland, and the penis. And so let's look and see where this stuff is. So here's the male reproductive tract. And what did I say instead of reproductive tract? What would be even a better name for this system? The diversification system, right, diversification system. Because we're all different, and it's really the purpose of this thing right here. Right? To make us different, just to produce new and unique individuals all the time. All right, so here is the testes right here. This is where sperm is produced. This is where testosterone is produced. There's some little tubules inside the testes called seminiferous tubules that produce sperm. And then these sperm go through those tubules to the epididymis, which kind of wraps around the testes a little bit. And then there's a tube that carries it to the outside world. We call this the vas deferens. Comes back up into your pelvic cavity around the bladder. And it goes past a couple glands called the seminal vesicles and the prostate gland right here. These add things to the ejaculate to make the sperm more motile and to keep them healthy. Because in the urethra, it's very acidic, and that would decrease the motility of sperm. And sperm have a little flagellum on them, right? So here's what a sperm looks like. It has that flagellum, so they're swimming around all the time. But if they go into a very acidic environment, that flagellum is not going to work, and they can't swim, and they'll never fertilize an egg as a result of that. So it's the process of some of the secretions of some of these glands that activate sperm and help neutralize acids in various parts of the body, including the female vagina, which is relatively acidic, that would neutralize sperm, and that would not be adaptive either. All right, then sperm travels through this ejaculatory duct within the prostate, and then after that it joins the urethra. So it becomes part of the urinary system, the reproductive tract, in males. Okay? Not so in females. Females are very much different. They never form a single duct. Like the vagina never joins the urethra in the female. That would be something that we see here in the male, but that doesn't happen in the female. Urethra goes all the way through the penis to the urogenital opening right here. Okay. There's another gland called the bulbourethral gland. Sometimes we call that the Cowper's gland. That secretes a little bit of mucus. What's mucus good for? It's lubrication, but it's a protein. We found that it's being secreted in the stomach. What does it do to the lining of the stomach? Mucus in the stomach protects the lining from being digested due to the hydrochloric acid and the enzymes that are in the stomach. And it's kind of the same thing for this mucus right here too. Mucus is a protein. It acts as a buffer. It neutralizes the acid environment of the male urethra and the inside the vagina. So it acts as a lubrication, but it's also a buffer that maintains a pH so that the sperm can swim around properly. Okay. Now remember, way back when, I mentioned that it's very rare for a whole population to come down with the same disease process. And when we talked about bones, however, I said here is a glaring example of an exception to that rule. Because every woman, if you live long enough, what will you be faced with? Osteoporosis, which is a depletion of calcium from your bones and will make your bones weaker and brittle. Okay? And I said at that time I would point out another example, but not in females, but in males. And I want to call your attention to this prostate gland right here. If a male lives long enough, just about every male, they will have problems with their prostate gland. Because as you get older, the prostate gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. We call that hypertrophy. Prostatic hypertrophy. Guess what happens to you when this prostate gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger? Yeah, it's not that you walk around funny, but you can't pee. Right? Because what? It is constricting the urethra coming from the urinary bladder right here. So because you can't completely relieve yourself, you always have the urgency to what? To go to the bathroom. Okay, so that's kind of a nuisance. But something else can happen too. And that is, sometimes when the prostate gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger, when it hypertrophies, it turns cancerous. Right? And then it's a very difficult situation because you need to determine if that prostate gland, when it grows, when it hypertrophies, is it benign, which happens most of the time, or is it cancerous? And if it's benign and a person can still urinate enough to where they have a normal life, you don't need to do anything about it. But if it's cancerous, guess what? Then you need to ablate that cancerous prostate. Or if the prostate is so big that somebody can't urinate, then again, you have to surgically do something to that prostate. Yeah. Why does it get bigger? It's a natural process of the prostate gland when it's not used enough. Okay? How's that sound? And I'll tell you why in a second. But I don't think we really understand why it hypertrophies, but it probably has something to do with diet and exercise. Okay. Well, remember, what did we say about osteoporosis? What is one way to protect yourself with osteoporosis? Diet and exercise. Diet, namely what? You have good calcium in your diet premenopausally. And then, of course, exercise premenopausally, because when you exercise, when you stress a bone, you cause calcium deposition. You cause that bone to get stronger and thicker, and then that just means that you can afford to lose more calcium post-menopause and you won't feel the effects so early on of osteoporosis. Okay? The same thing for this prostate gland right here. Diet and exercise. Diet, namely low-fat diet, seems to be protective, and exercise as well. And a lot of you were smiling because I'm not talking about exercise on an exercise bicycle or treadmill. Right? I'm talking about exercising this diversification system right here, making the prostate do what it's normally supposed to do, which is what? Add fluid to, right, to the ejaculate. So ejaculation would be the exercise I'm talking about. Okay? All right, so we're still learning a lot about that disease, and it's kind of interesting how little we know about it, considering that every male will be faced with this situation as you get older. Okay, but that's just the nature of the topic. Okay. So some other structures. Penis. Right here, you can see that there are some like sinusoids inside the penis. These fill up with blood that maintain an erection. And there are two kinds of erectile tissue inside the penis. This ventral region right here is what we call the corpus spongiosum, and it surrounds the urethra. There's another one right here. This is what we call the dorsal erectile tissue. This is the corpus cavernosum, and you have two of those on either side of the urethra. And so if that was the case, if you're talking about both of them, that would be the corpora cavernosa, would be plural for that term. Right? It's not another object. And then you have the glans penis right here, which is an extension of the corpus spongiosum, and that's the erectile tissue as well. And erection then happens and is maintained when these sinuses fill up with blood, when they dilate. So vasodilators will cause these erections to take place. And I think that's really the basis of a lot of drugs like Viagra and other kinds of drugs will cause a vasodilation. And then hopefully those vessels will constrict by themselves. I forget what it's called when it doesn't happen, when they don't constrict. Then that erection is maintained for hours and hours and hours. And it will cause necrosis of the penis and it will fall off. So it's a very dangerous condition. I forget, it starts with a P, I forget what it's called. Priapism. Priapism, that's right, priapism. Okay, is a side effect of some of these drugs. Okay, you're right, priapism. And then the only way to get rid of priapism, you've got to go to an ER and then they have to suck some of the blood out of there with a syringe. Well, it's better than having that blood just stay in the penis and then necrose and then have your penis fall off. Okay, so, yeah, so somebody that has priapism probably needs some support to go to the emergency room to have that blood aspirated out of there. Okay. All right, so this is a nice sagittal view of the male reproductive tract. Let's see I think I have another slide or two. Okay, let's trace and see where how sperm is produced and what kind of tubes it goes through. I said it's produced in the seminal vesicles. Where are these seminal vesicles at? Here we go. So let's look inside a testes right here. So here's the testes. Here are some seminiferous tubules, and sperm is produced in the seminiferous tubules. It's collected in these ducts over here, and then it ends up in these ducts over here. I guess you don't have to know the names of these ducts. But then it ends up in this big one right over here, coiled around the outside of the testes. That's what we call the epididymis. And then during ejaculation, sperm evolves from the epididymis into the vas deferens. And then it enters the peritoneal cavity. So if we look inside a seminiferous tubule right here, a cross section, right, we can see some sperm and we can see some germ cells. The sperm come from germ cells. And there's some other cells in here as well. Do I give you a list? Yeah, Sertoli cells and interstitial cells. How come you don't have a picture of that? Let's see. Well, I'll just draw it in. Okay. So along with germ cells that produce these sperm, there are some other cells right here that we call Sertoli. And Sertoli cells, well, it's just not on this diagram. These Sertoli cells support spermatogenesis, right? So I'm going to say promote spermatogenesis. which means what? Making of sperm. And these are inside the seminiferous tubule. Outside the seminiferous tubule, see the seminiferous tubule right here? There are some cells on the outside. We call those interstitial cells. Sometimes we also call them Leydig cells. And they have a different function. They secrete testosterone. So cells inside the seminiferous tubule are important for spermatogenesis and promoting that process, namely the Sertoli cells, but it's the cells that are outside the seminiferous tubules, inside the testes, the interstitial cells, or the cells of Leydig, that produce testosterone. So that's probably important to know. The germ cells are the progenitor cells for sperm. So sperm cells come from germ cells. Or germinal. So where germ comes from is from the word germinal, which is a little bit different than a stem cell. I suppose I could put that on the board. A germ cell, what does a germ cell make? Let's erase. Can I erase the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? This is kind of handy to know. A germ cell is going to make a gamete. Give me some examples of gametes. Yeah, sperm is one. Yeah, or ovum, egg, right? Sperm or egg. And that process is meiosis that does that. Okay. There are other kinds of cells that we call stem cells. And stem cells are a kind of cell that can become, let me not draw it up that way. A stem cell can become any other kind of cell in your body. It could become muscle. It could become nerve. Or it could become connective tissue. But once something has become a muscle, can it change what it is and become a nerve? Right? Or can a nerve turn into a muscle? It can't. All right? So this is what we call differentiation. Differentiation. And a muscle can't go back to being a stem cell. And a muscle can't become any of these other ones. All right, so there's an inherent difference between a germ cell and a stem cell. Some people use them interchangeably, and it's not quite right. All right, so gametes don't come from stem cells. They come from germinal cells or germ cells. You'll even see that, say, in a newspaper, for instance. And you would get confused. Okay, so how does sperm, when it moves from the scrotum in through the vas deferens back up into the pelvic cavity, it goes through the spermatic cord. And you might be wondering, why on earth is the testes outside the pelvic cavity? Why is it suspended in the scrotum? Yep, because spermatogenesis requires a colder than normal body temperature. So if these testes were up in the pelvic cavity, sperm wouldn't be produced, but something actually much worse would happen too. The testes would become cancerous. And we call that a cryptorchid. This testes is what we call an orchid, an ovary is an orchid. Okay, cryptorchid means hidden. And in the male, it shouldn't be hidden in the pelvic cavity. It should be descended into the testes so that it's cooler. Okay, if it is a cryptorchid, then it has to be removed because it eventually will turn cancerous and then it will kill that individual. So, of course, that's important for people, but if you raise animals at home, like dogs and cats, If it's a male, that's always something you check to see that there are, how many testes in that scrotum? That there are two, right? And then if there aren't two, then you schedule a little ultrasound at your veterinarian and they find where that other one is, and if it's in the pelvic cavity, then they remove it, okay, so that it doesn't kill that animal later on. Okay. So along the vas deferens right here, you have a number of things, okay, called the spermatic cord. There's a testicular artery, there's a testicular vein, there's a nerve, there's some connective tissue, and there's even a skeletal muscle called the cremaster muscle that makes up the spermatic cord. And I'm sure your book has a picture of it. I don't know what happened to my picture of it. Okay, but that's what's holding the testicle in place inside the scrotum. Okay. Then after the vas deferens, we said it goes into what? The ejaculatory duct past the seminal vesicle. Right, so here's the vas deferens going past the seminal vesicle and then the ejaculatory duct through the prostate. What do these things really produce? The seminal vesicle produces about 60% of the semen volume, and it produces sperm nutrients, things that activate sperm so that they can swim around. Right, the prostate forms about 30% of the semen volume, and it produces a neutralizing solution for the acid environment in the urethra and the vagina. And the bulbourethral gland forms about 5% of the semen volume, and that secretes mucus for lubrication, and it also acts as a buffer for pH. Right? And then after that, then sperm is in the urethra and finds its way all the way outside the body. Okay. Let's see what's next. Maybe it is almost time for a quiz. Time for a quiz. I believe so. So next time, we'll start from here.